The Two Stop In podcast series is inspired by the memory of the last surviving founder of the Australian Cinematographer Society, my friend, the late John Leake ACS. When he and his wife Marion retired from the film industry, they bought a little motel outside Sydney, and it became a tradition for cinematographers and other filmmakers to stop in and have relaxed conversations about the industry and the craft of cinematography. It earned the nickname of the T-Stop Inn. This series sets out to recapture the spirit of those conversations, but this time, we're inviting you to listen in.
The T-Stop Inn.
ACS member Susan Lumsden has amazing experience working across almost every aspect of both live and pre-recorded television. She recently drew on many of those skills to shoot drama in one of the most inhospitable environments on the planet. Susan, welcome to the T-Stop Inn.
Well, thank you for having me.
So how did that happen and what was it like?
The lead actress actually got sick. It got moved to Calgary in Canada and in winter.
Wow.
Which... I've done a fair amount of filming for in winter environments for the Paralympics, and I love filming the Northern Lights in the Arctic up in Norway. So I kind of had a bit of experience in that area, but I don't think the director quite did. And so we did. We headed off to Calgary, and it turned out to be the coldest week of the year.
So how cold are we talking there?
We're talking down to minus 37.
Wow. I was going to say Celsius or Fahrenheit, but... At that point, it doesn't matter that
much. It's pretty close on either way, but it was Celsius.
Wow, that is seriously cold.
It certainly was a difficult environment to work in, not only, you know, physically and the gear was an issue. Even just like the second AC from Canada came up to me and with the Panavision lens, he said, I can't get the caps off the lenses. Just physically, they were freezing on. And it was like, okay, at the start of the day in the camera truck, take the caps off the lenses, but make sure that when they go back at the end of the day that those caps go back on.
Yeah.
But even just having to think about if we had to do something like shots inside a bus, which they brought out to the, because mostly filming exteriors in a field. It's like making sure the camera stayed warm and that was scheduled the first shoot, the lenses stayed warm. Mm. And two, we had everything prepped and into the bus because the bus was freezing cold. And then having the right amount of warm lenses to shoot in the bus.
Wow.
Because the minute they got cold, they took at least in those temperatures like 3 hours to warm back up and dry out again and stop fogging.
Wow.
And so it was just planning, okay, keep those lenses aside, keep them in one of the RVs, nice and warm, and
wow.
That till we go to do that. And then if the director changed their mind on the shot and they wanted a totally different lens, it was like, unfortunately, they're cold now.
So what sort of range of lenses did you have?
We had we used the Panavision E-series.
Mm,
and
nice.
We had a complete set from 35, 40, 50, 75, 100, 135 and 180.
Nice.
And that, which was really nice to have that range.
And they were chosen for the aesthetics?
Yeah, very much for the look. Even though we weren't doing anamorphic flares in this film, just for the anamorphic look of those lenses. They were the right kind of combination because a little bit of handheld and just the look as well. Whereas the E-series as opposed to ACLs. The ACLs are so big and heavy.
Yeah.
If you go to do any handheld with them, they're just...
You know, they still have that anamorphic character to them, but not as extreme as, say, the C-series.
Yeah, so nice
balance.
Yeah. The look of the film is kind of that emotional, it's emotional sci-fi
wow.
type, the cold winter,
yeah.
And it really just suited the tone of the film.
And what cameras did you have those on?
We had the Alexa XT Plus. We've had a mini on a couple of days.
And how did the XT Plus go in that environment?
Basically, we just popped it out in the snow, turned it on in the morning, turned off in the evening, and it was absolutely happy.
Wow.
We actually really didn't have to do much. But then the Alexa is one of the few cameras where the sensor itself is heated.
Yes, that's right, yes. We tend to think so much about the sensors overheating. But it's interesting to think about, okay, you're running the camera all day and it's still having to warm the sensor. So I guess in that environment, the Alexa has a big advantage.
It has a huge advantage. And also in the blacks, because in the extreme cold, if you had a normal camera, you'd have to keep re-black balancing all the time
yeah, yeah.
to make sure as those temper fluctuations that it didn't affect the black balance. But because it's heated to exactly one temperature and that you don't have to worry about the sense of freezing, you don't have to worry about the black balance and that. So, yeah. it was rock solid, and we even got hit by a blizzard. So snowing on it. It really was a good camera. It's so dry there with the snow too. It's not like our snow, which is wet. It falls on your camera, it melts everywhere. It just never melted. So you just brush it off things and that, because it's just so cold, so dry. Even the second AC accidentally knocked a coffee cup over on the director's monitor trolley. I was just standing there saying, I think you better wipe that out really quickly before I even finish the sentence, it had frozen over.
Wow.
The other day, two buckets of hot water to try and get the coffee off, frozen off the trolley. It just happened so quick. You couldn't touch any gear without gloves on at any stage. Your hand would just instantly start to freeze to
it. So what was that like operating?
It meant you're operating in, a lot of times, in mitt. When it was really, one day was like, it was the warmest day actually. I think it was minus 17, but we had a wind chill factor down to minus 37. General thing is wear mitts, keep the little heated mitts on as well as you can. Take your hands out with little light gloves, adjust things on the camera, and if it's not too bad a day, you can operate for a little while without them and then put them back into the warm mitts, and you just can't touch anything. But if it's really, really windy, it just cuts through really quickly and you just have to operate in mitts.
So were you tending to operate off an LCD or through the viewfinder?
Through the viewfinder,
and how did the viewfinder handle the cold?
Well, lucky enough, they're heated viewfinders for the Arris.
Ah,
so that's another advantage of the Alexa, is the heated viewfinder.
Yeah,
fantastic. And I'm used to always working with a nice little chamois on the viewfinder. Well, they froze rock solid, so we got rid of them the first day. And we took my first AC from the film across to Canada with us. It was really hard on his hands, trying to do focus pulling in those colds, trying to do fine position things and that. And also standing still, if we were standing still for any period of time, I twice had to tell him to go inside and get his feet warm, because I could see he was standing there, he was getting into pain with his hands and his feet.
Wow.
And tell him, just go into the RV, get warm, come back. Which is another thing, it was also juggling safety issues both for the actors and for the crew in those temperatures. And a lot of that I had to be guided by the Canadian crew. Basically, they said at minus 40, they don't go out. That was the cutoff point. And we did have one day where we did not film outside. We took the one standby interior scene because it was just going to be too cold. So we went in and did interiors that day.
And that's where I guess you just got to trust the locals that they know what they're talking about.
Exactly. Well, they live in these conditions.
Yeah. If they're saying it's too cold, it's
too cold.
Yeah.
Another day we just had the massive wind chill, and even to put the actors out in that, we only filmed one scene that day. But we got it done. We ended up taking all the unit trucks and the RVs, and we built a windbreak. It took us all morning to build this windbreak with the vehicles, and to create this area that the actors could work in where we'd taken the wind off them. So it was kind of like, how do we juggle this? This is the scenery background. This is where we want the vehicles.
The pace of shooting
slower.
Yeah, it'd be completely different.
One of the things I thought was, how do the guys lay all the tracks in all that snow? And you don't think about these things until you go, I hope that's easy. And they did. They just laid them and made it work. But it was slower going. Everything took probably twice as long to set up.
And so that was part of the film was shot there in Calgary?
Yeah.
And where was the rest of it shot?
The rest of it shot in Australia. And that some of the American actors were brought across to Australia.
Hmm.
And we did a lot of interior scenes here and that. So the rest was done exteriors, and the rest of the interior scenes were done in Calgary.
And so this is a film for TV, theatrical?
Theatrical.
Fantastic.
And, so,
and so how did you come to be involved in this particular project?
I got asked to come do an interview. The director was looking for a DOP. It was his first time.
Wow.
And so he's been on a huge learning curve.
Yeah.
It's his first major film. So his first time with Panavision, first time with us. And that went for the interview. I wasn't kind of expecting whether I'd get it or not, so I was quite surprised. And because I had done drama at the ABC for many years, and I really had wanted to go back, and I started to do a few short films on my weekends while I was still at the ABC, and try and get back into it. Just at the right time as I was leaving the ABC, this came up. Literally walked out of the ABC and ended up starting on the feature.
Wow. Because you were at the ABC for quite a long time.
Yeah, about 30 years at the ABC. The majority of my career has been television.
Yeah, yeah. And so you came through that same kind of training program that Tom Gleason was talking about when he was here.
Yes, yeah. It was a great institution at that time, a great teaching institution, but it was also in a state of change. Part of Tom and my year was to try and heal this divide between what was the then film department and the engineering department. So our traineeship had been designed to do both.
And
the trainees ahead of us had only ever got engineering and never got film. So we got the mix of the both from everything. But we had to train in everything as well. So we had to train in film editing, electronic editing, film camera, electronic camera, film sound, electronic sound.
What an incredibly valuable grounding.
It turned out to be later when everything kind of changed. Mm. It was like, okay, it's an amalgamation of both of the structures we've learned. It was just like fantastic when the editing came out. Oh, there's, we'll go back to what we could do in film. But it's now electronic.
So, yeah, so the whole shift to digital and digital cinema cameras must have been your two worlds coming together.
It was. I think that's one of the things I embraced it really quickly. And that, so I always love jumping on new cameras and things. So that traineeship was the best grounding I probably could have got anywhere.
From that traineeship, you went into working at the ABC?
Yeah, I was very lucky. I ended up with a camera position in the outside broadcast department, which I was the first female operator.
Wow.
Two of us as trainees got pulled out probably 8 months before the end of our traineeships. But our final year was specialisation. We'd specialised in camera. For certain reasons, they lost a few cameramen at that point. Either they'd gone on to other things or for health reasons, they couldn't do camera anymore. And these two positions came up. So I went straight out of my traineeship into a camera position, which was pretty unheard of. You know, normally you used to wait about 10 years to get a camera position at the ABC.
And so outside broadcast, how big an advantage do you think it was for you to have had that grounding then in that kind of operating?
It was in the heyday of that type of... So I did everything from live operas to ballet to stage and theatre productions, sport of every variety. We did classical concerts. So it gave you this great grounding in
all these...
And
there's no take two?
No. You had to, like an opera, you'd have a shot card and you might have 200 shots for your camera. Between the three acts going over 3-4 hours, and it gave you discipline and
focus
very
in
much
every sense of the word.
And it also gave you great skills, your ability to make snap decisions quickly, your ability to focus. It really nailed your focus.
And I guess a lot of long lens.
A lot of long lens operating. Even it came back to, because I went on to a magazine. Sporting show, the ABC for sport for children. All my doing golf, following golf with me, when I, shooting it on a, SP beta and that and DG beta later, it was just like I could follow the golf ball through the air on the NG camera because I had that training and know how to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, so it helped me in all different ways. But it was, you had to do drama as well. Even you did the gardening show. And that's how I did gardening with Sandra and Graham Ross. Graham Ross went on to do Better Homes and Gardens afterward. Yeah. And so we went through from that. But then everything slowly went single camera. Eventually, from out of that outside broadcast, I was virtually shooting, I think, 90% of my work by the end was single camera. And that I'd like it had been an operator on GP and it had gone from multi-camera to single camera.
Yeah.
So we'd gone through all of this kind of change that was happening, which meant that they turned around and said, oh, would you like a position in what was then the field department, which was the old cine camera department.
Right.
And I said, oh, yes, I wouldn't mind. And I swapped. So I then swapped and went on to do documentaries and that, as well as still staying a little bit in drama. But then that changed and I ended up in comedy and light entertainment. And
was there still any film being shot at that point?
Yes. Because in the 90s, I changed over. I think
the ABC
it was
kind of hung in there for quite a
while. A long while,
yeah.
Four Corners was the last to stop shooting 16 and they didn't finish until 2000.
2000, wow.
Yeah. It might have been even 2001 because they went straight from film 16mm film, which was reversible, which was not very forgiving, and then went to digibeta. So they skipped analog
totally.
It wasn't quite good
enough.
Which
might have been quite a wise decision.
I think so. Archivally, I think a much better decision.
Yeah, I think that 16 would probably be holding up a lot better than a lot of the certainly the early Betacam material these days.
Very much so. If you scan it properly. Now with a nice scanner.
Yeah.
And it's there was a lot of neg still being shot for programs.
Drama.
For drama and high-end documentaries were still shot neg. And the decisions was early made for some shoots to even like down to Antarctica to use the 16mm neg for exteriors and like while you're on the boat and you're shooting on the boat, do them on SP beta. So they use mixed formats.
Yeah, which is a very British approach, isn't it?
Very much so. It's not all the British dramas in the early years were film outside and electronic inside.
Which you kind of look at now and it's like, how did that make sense? But it was a style. It was the British style for dramas and comedy.
Even the ABC, I was a camera assistant at the time, so I worked on Mother and Son. But it was done, similar things on those early programs. You had two different units. You'd have the studio guys shoot all those interiors.
Multi-camera.
And sometimes in the early years, there were film cameras, and then later they were electronic. Mm. Once SP Beta or Digi Beta came in, then that allowed them to do that location shooting. Otherwise, to do drama outside when I first started,
just too difficult.
It was two cameras with a truck, and it was switched.
Yeah.
With a 2-inch tape deck. It was an outside broadcast, effectively. Yeah. Yeah, and doing the gardening show that way. And now,
really?
Yeah. Which is probably the way I learned to shoot gardening. It was multi-cameras. So.
Wow.
These days you just shoot the gardening exactly the same way, but you just move the camera around. It was a whole change, but I think it was great to go through that change.
Mm.
It also gave you great discipline.
Discipline and a great perspective on where things kind of went next.
Yeah.
So what sort of documentaries did you work on?
I did a series on the Dead Sea Scrolls for the ABC, and we shot that all around the world because we had to go to all the universities that had the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then out to Jerusalem, out to the actual archaeological site.
Wow.
And that, so I did that series. I did a couple of series for Compass, another one on Buddhism, the rise of Buddhism in the West and the decline in the East.
Interesting.
And that, so and a couple more international ones for them.
So what were those shot on?
They were just changing to 16:9. So the first one or two were done on DVX-30s. They were the first widescreen cameras the ABC got.
Yeah.
And that they were bought in for a drama called Dog's Head Bay, but I don't think they ended up being used for it.
Right.
And they were sitting on the shelf. And it was before the ABC got DigiBeta. So the only choice to get widescreen was these ones.
Ah, right. So they were dockable,
and it was DV cam on the back.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
it was kind of before DigiBeta actually kind of came out. It was an interim and that. So we used those on a couple of the series just to get the widescreen. Otherwise, it would have been the choice of SP Beta. So later on, once we got DigiBetas, because the ABC came to DigiBeta quite late, not till 2001. Yeah. They bought them ex the Olympics.
Oh, right. Well, that makes sense then.
So they got a good price.
Yeah, good package deal. And so from there you started doing light entertainment?
Yes, I worked on programs like The O'Loughlin Tonight, did all the location skits for that, then went on to Chaser's War and Everything, lots of Chaser programs.
That must have been fun.
It was really fun. And the guys
Bit crazy?
It was very crazy. The guys were lovely to work with. But you didn't know what was going to be happening from one week to the next. I did manage to avoid not getting arrested. I was actually on holidays when that happened. I was in Peru. Very good timing to be on holidays.
You had a solid run of, I think, quite a few different programs. And then you came to the point where you went freelance.
Yes. I was already thinking about the going freelance. And the timing just turned out to be perfect for me. And the ABC decided to get rid of all of its internal production crews.
Really?
And they'd slowly been taking them away from all the other states. Melbourne and Sydney was left. And they decided, okay, we're going to just get rid of all the crews. And we're all made redundant. And for me, it was just... perfect timing.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me to be a crazy direction for an organisation like that to go, but it sounds like it was very convenient for you personally.
It just worked out for me, and I think one of the great things was it also gave me that impetus to do that push back into drama.
Yeah.
And that, yeah. So.
So what do you find most interesting and satisfying about drama?
I love the lighting.
I like that.
And that, I think that was one of the things I missed in outside broadcast was the ability to do lighting, because that was always done by the lighting guys. But when I went into the documentaries by transferring the film department, I got control of lighting and could actually experiment more and learn more. So I think the documentary was great because it gave me all of that ability to learn that and to use things, because by that point I'd actually worked on a drama series with Jeff Burton and Lou Irving with the DOPs.
Fantastic.
And that, so getting to watch them work was really great. And then I went into the documentary, I'll try that. Expand. But that's what I'm really loving about the drama, is the lighting. Because a lot of TV work, you don't have time to do the lighting, not the way you really want to, because you've got to, you know, you've got to just get it shot in the time that's allotted in the budget.
It's on the recent feature. What's that called, by the way?
Risen.
Risen. So on Risen, what sort of lighting fixtures were you using on that predominantly?
A whole mixture of everything from Ditos to 1x2 panels to HMI, 1x2 HMIs mostly. We didn't go too much bigger than that because it was a fairly limited budget.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a mixture of those. Working out how we wanted our LED light. A lot of hazmat suits in this as well.
Right.
And that's just a lot of LED lighting had to be put into hazmat suits and masks. And but, yeah, that's basically our package was...
I mean, LED lights have made such a big difference in recent years, haven't they?
They have, and they've actually dramatically improved. Mm. In the early years, the LEDs were bad. But no, these days, any good quality brand...
They've come a long way in a short space of time.
And it also allows you to use a smaller package. You don't need as much big generators. You can just run... Because we really did have to run off basically house power.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. And you can actually do that with LEDs and still get a bit of punch.
Yes, and you can get the ability to have that soft light without having to put multiple fixtures and have big distances.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Some of the 1x2 panels, really small 1x2 panels, it just can get them in just the right angle where you want in a normal house ceiling. Hmm. And that they just give you a bit of freedom that you didn't have before. I do remember when Ditos came in, and that was the thing about the Dito. Oh, we can control that light right down.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find that there's any tricks that you've kind of picked up or developed doing docos that you were tending to use on the feature?
I think when you're running out of time and you need to cut corners, that's when your doco background really does come in. It's especially with working with available light, working with house fixtures, just being able to cut light off, and that when you need to, without actually putting a fixture in, but actually taking some away to get the same effect. Especially with modern cameras, because they're much more sensitive. It's not like the early years of film. And that.
Shoving light in there to get an exposure.
That's right.
Taking light away, negative fill, just becomes more and more useful, doesn't it?
It does. And it, from the early years, from my first film days when we did film it, it was like, okay, we've just got to get up there to get an exposure. We've just got to get it lit. Yeah. You've got this big 1K's pouring in and then 2K's at times. And it's just like, we're just getting something happening.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas now you can actually play and paint with the light.
Yeah, and you can do that really quite easily and quickly by comparison.
Yes, it's just so much easier. And, you're not just in the early days, you always had hard light.
Mm.
You had no soft lights generally in your kit. You had hard lights and then you had to soften it off. Whereas now you can start with a soft light and then you can soften it further.
Yes. It's interesting when I find when you look at a lot of that kind of golden age of Hollywood, what they called very, very soft light back then, and it's kind of what we now would call, you know, slightly soft, that starting point.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fact that we're able to so quickly and easily get to a very, very soft source. And often in confined spaces as well.
But it also, I think, gives you that very naturalistic type of lighting these days.
Yeah.
I really like that style.
Mm. It's something that I've had quite a few conversations with various cinematographers about over the years, particularly Butch Calderwood. The value of learning with hard light and then applying that skill to soft light rather than just learning on soft light.
I think learning to light with hard light is a great way of going, and that's the way we started.
Mm.
Because when you've got a situation where you've just got to use hard light, you can make it soft.
Yes.
But you also gain through learning how to make hard light soft, you gain a great understanding of soft light itself, how it works.
Just how light behaves.
Exactly. How also soft light is, you know, bounces everywhere. Then you've got to control it.
Yep, yep.
And that's not like hard light where you can just stick it and virtually get it down to a point.
Yes.
And that is controlling soft light is then you need to learn
that's
how
where
to,
the challenge is with soft light, yeah. I find being conscious of what's possible with the grade now can be very useful in terms of when you're in a small space and you have a lot of soft light bouncing around, that can be incredibly time-consuming to control on set. And yet in the grade, that can often be very quick and easy.
Yeah, it's great being able to make a decision based on, okay, I know I can let that go because we can do that much quicker in the grade.
Mm.
We're running out of light. I've got 20 minutes and that we can just do this.
Yep.
Otherwise, if I go to fix that, it's going to take us half an hour. We'll have lost our light.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
go for it, fix it in the grade.
Yep, yep.
And that. And it's that thing of it being that experience of kind of going, okay, I can let that go. And that's a hard thing. It takes time to learn that and then knowing, okay, no, I can't let that go.
Yes, yeah, which compromises to make.
Yeah. And it's all about compromises.
Yeah, yeah. When you were working on stuff at the ABC, how often did you get to be involved in the grading process there? And how much of the material was graded?
It depends show by show. And it depends on the ABC's budget. Like if you look at Chaser's War on Everything, that never went to a colour grade.
Yeah.
And that Gardening Australia.
It should just be turnaround time as much as anything.
Exactly. Sometimes we were shooting up to like 2 hours before it was due on air, which is why they went so quickly tapeless.
Yes,
they were really the first program to go tapeless because we got a prototype P2 camera. We got the prototype. We go to the editor. Are you sure you can cut this? He said, "Yeah, I'll have it working by the time you get back." We went out, shot it, came back, and he worked out how to ingest it, how to cut it.
Wow. Because that's another funny thing, I guess, in a lot of ways. For decades, people were talking about, you know, tape is king, film's dead one day. And the irony is that basically film outlived tape.
I did. With the shift to solid-state memory, we basically got back in a way towards film because tape had taken away so much from us. You couldn't do time-lapse. You couldn't do variable speed. You couldn't do anything with your shutter. You were stuck with this camera, which was basically at 50 frames per second, and that was just about it.
Yeah, yeah.
I was actually doing a little bit of teaching recently at the ABC for some of their new interns on C100, 200s. And they go, "Oh, how do you feel about, you know, finally having something you can actually do, you know, time-lapse, or you can do variable speed now? You never could do that before." And I said, "Well, no, actually, it's come back because we lost it. We had it when we started with film."
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of coming round.
Yeah.
And it's nice to get also the dynamic range back.
Yes.
And that we had with film with Nick.
Essentially, when I was talking to Mark Toyer, and he was saying, in his opinion, clearly the digital cameras now, the high-end digital cameras, have more dynamic range than film. It was interesting to hear him put it that directly. I mean,
definitely much better than reversal, isn't it? About that. Don't think I want to go back to reversal days.
I think that's a fair call.
Be interesting to know whether anybody's done any tests to see where we are sitting now, because
yeah. I think there's this, because of course there's all the manufacturers claiming X stops of dynamic range, and that kind of gets into that whole thing of what's measurable dynamic range and what's usable dynamic range, and I think there's a very blurry line between the two.
Well, there's also that factor between like your ISO, where you're putting your ISO can actually affect the dynamic range of the camera.
Yeah, yeah.
So the cleaner you go, the less dynamic range you've got.
Yes.
And the more you push the camera, the more dynamic range you gain.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like.
And so you then have that balancing act between dynamic range and noise.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of sums up a lot of what cinematography is about. It's kind of a constant balancing act. It's, you know, you lose a bit of this, gain a bit of that.
It often is. It's always this kind of compromise about, you know, how can you make something work? Can I push the camera a little bit further?
Yeah.
When you've got all the time and the money in the world, you can fix everything. Often that's never the case on set.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like it's always a compromise. It's sun setting, you know, the light's changing. You know, we'd have time to get, you know, a big 12 by 12 in. But no, we don't have time to get the 12 by 12. How do we make this work?
Yeah, yeah.
How do we get this before we lose the light on this location, or the actor's got to go, So it's always just trying to make the best decisions you can at the time. And there's never a right or wrong way. There's only good and bad results.
Yeah, yeah. You know, what works best for what you're trying to achieve. And
That's been, I think, the hardest thing with this film. As opposed, I did another low-budget film last year, and it was just a straight, you know, five-week shoot. Whereas this one, there was this break in the middle and trying to keep remembering our look and keep our same look going from the first basically bracket of shooting to this delay later shooting, keeping that look consistent going, oh, my God, what do we... Because some things we are completing scenes that were shot earlier.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I've never been in this situation before. Any other time was on an ABC drama where Hugo Weaving got sick.
Right.
And the doctors said that, no, he couldn't continue on, and they had to shut production down for a couple of days. And that, but never kind of this first one where it's been a long break.
Yeah, yeah. And so in terms of the look, were you just working with the standard Arri LUT? Yeah, or did you do anything different?
I ended up going with a LUT that I spoke with Alexi has given to me, and that... and that, which I've been quite...
Alexei Vanawa?
Yes, yeah. So we had a bit of a discussion, put that his one in and that. So we've been using that one, which works for me. I like the look on this one, so...
Fantastic.
And hopefully we can follow that all through the grades.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah,
it's not far off the. It's just a little bit different. There's probably a little bit kind of colder look,
okay.
which suits this whole film. It's very emotional and psychological. So
there's something I find great about working with a LUT is that you've got that consistency there. That as long as they apply that LUT to the edit footage, if they apply that as the starting point for the grade, you know at least that is stable.
Yes, yeah.
And you can kind of tweak from there, but at least that you know what you're starting with. Like a one light print.
Exactly. At least when I see the rushes, it's all got that one LUT on it, which is great. And then I know from there.
And it also feeds back into, you know, your exposure decisions and lighting decisions that you know where you're at and you can look at it and go, well, that worked. I might pull that back a bit.
And I'm very lucky on this one. They actually shot RAW, Codex RAW, which is like, it's been great because it's like I can look at the underlying full scale and go, that's there in the RAW.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got room in the grade so I can let that go and we know we can hold it.
Yeah.
Which... is a really nice thing to have, especially in snow, shooting snow. That RAW is just a really added advantage to...
Yeah, it would really come into its own there.
Oh, yeah.
So what sort of ISO ratings were you working at in the snow?
In the snow, mostly I kept it at 800. Where we have done some VFX stuff, I've actually gone back to about 400.
Okay.
And that just to make it a little bit cleaner
for
those things. Most of it 800 in the snow.
And so you would have been using a fair bit of ND there.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's some scenes... Some scenes we start with 2.1 and we end up with nothing just to keep my f-stop consistent throughout the whole scene with the totally changing light.
Yeah.
Because the worst bit was, you know, is a blizzard coming? And suddenly you start and you've got, it might be a nice overcast day and then you start the scene and the little bit, oh, it's looking lovely in the VFX and put a little bit back on the earlier shots and that, it's just like... Oh no, it's getting heavier. Oh no, it's getting heavier. Until the director asked me, oh, how do you think the last take was? I'm not quite sure because it's a close-up, but I couldn't really see the actress's face for the snow.
And so what sort of stop were you working at on the E-series lenses?
Mostly around 4 and then down to 2. We're basically sometimes running them wide open for my poor focus puller because he's really good. He never complains.
So you'd be in the kind of which eyelash do you want in focus territory.
Oh, yeah. Because we didn't have a big lighting package at times, we were very much down low.
Just using that to get exposure.
Yeah. Using every bit out of the lenses and the camera we could.
So you're pushing ISO up to 1600?
I never went above 12.
Because I've heard quite a lot of people say that, you know, they're comfortable going up to 1200 on the Alexa. And
I've never gone 16. I've just never gone that.
Yeah.
But 12 I have gone to, yeah. The problem is a lot of stuff in Calgary, once it was that dark, it looked dark.
Yeah.
So you just couldn't push it any further.
Yeah. So there's a point where you've got to say it's just...
It's just...
The light's gone.
The minute you try and light the foreground, your background's black.
Yeah.
It's just you can't light a paddock. No. There was only one time we did a night scene and that was because it was a truck that was part of the set.
Right.
And that way we could actually put up, you know, 1.2 or 4x4 and then a 12x12 and soften it right off and get it down to look like daylight. But that was about the only time we could go past the setting some point. And at that time of year, it got dark really quickly and very, very early. So it was dark by 5 o'clock, pitch black.
Wow.
And the light really didn't come up till 8 o'clock in the morning. And that, so you're often on set setting up in the darkness and packing up in the darkness.
Yeah, but I guess you'd still have quite nice light during the middle of the day.
During the middle of the day, it was nice. The worst thing for us was sunlight because it was the wrong tone for the shots. Mm. So then when I got sunlight, it was trying to scrim it down and try and just
control it
as much as we could to get the look right. And that, even the interior shots in the buses, like they went to go, the props guys go to clean the windows. No, leave the windows all fogged up. It's sunlight outside. I don't want to see the sunlight. And just get the grips to put a great big 12 by 20 silk down the whole side of the bus so that the sunlight coming in the bus was all softened. But don't clean those windows.
Well, I look forward to seeing it when it's finished. Sounds like it's going to be very, very visually interesting.
I've really enjoyed the challenge of doing it. Canada was challenging but very rewarding. And I'd definitely do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Susan, thanks for stopping in.
Well, thank you very much for having me.